This is take two of the interview with Harvey Sorum. All right.
When Harrington became president, of course, there was just no question. He specifically came out and stated that he wanted the University of Wisconsin to become outstanding in research.
I see.
Absolutely outstanding in research. Well, he was the president when I was at Stanford. And it turned out that his daughter, the youngest of the three, was a student of mine in chemistry at Stanford. So I got to know her and got to help. She was not all of the Stanford students are equally brilliant. Most of them are very brilliant. Mm-hmm. And the net result was that I helped her. Uh-huh. Well, the interesting thing is that when I got back here, I can't recall quite the circumstances, but one of the people who had been a teacher during the NSF program, mm-hmm. one of those two, had written in to the president of it, Harrington, to praise me. I had a nice letter of recommendation. And then I got back a copy of the letter and a copy of Harrington's response. And it was, I've got it, I can't remember exactly how it's stated, but something to the effect that he was pleased to hear some more good news about a professor, Sorum, about Professor Sorum, who has done so much for so many people, see. Hmm. But I don't know whether he knew that I wasn't getting a salary increase, merit increase, or not. But even though his daughter praised me, this person praised me, so he knew about me, mm-hmm. he didn't make any move to see to it that I got some salary increase there. In other words, he wasn't really concerned about undergraduate teaching. He passed off the letter, didn't call me in to talk to me at all, just send me a copy. Mm-hmm. And when he might have, called me up and said, gee, we've got this nice for you, and my daughter thinks you're a fine teacher. She told me that, but he never did. But so his concern was graduate work.
That's interesting. Did you go to department meetings regularly?
Oh, yes. When I got back, too. Uh-huh. Yes. I will say this, that I never was very articulate at departmental meetings because there was one thing that went on in the department that irritated me terribly, and that was this. Every year, the departments, and this was true of all departments, chemistry as well, but in chemistry department, every year, the department would apply for funds given by National Science Foundation or government funds. And let's say that there was a grant of $100,000 for this academic year. Mm-hmm. Okay. At the end of the academic year in June, there still would be, let's say, $30,000 not spent. Mm-hmm. So what would happen? We would get a note, a directive from the department that please send in your requests for additional purchases, because if we don't spend this money by a certain time, it'll be returned to the government. Mm-hmm. And if it's returned, then next year, instead of getting $100,000, we'll only get the $70,000. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So if we want to continue to get, we've got to find something to spend this on. So we'd spend it on something. Oh, it griped me because, in other words, you just created a thing for which you wanted to spend money, yeah, when you really didn't need the money. Mm. Say, you should have returned it. Say, well, I expressed myself that I thought we ought to return the money.
Yeah. Well, that didn't go over very
well. Oh, no, that didn't go over at all. See. Now, the interesting thing is, you see, that you read about is what's happening in Washington now.
Their objection to just that sort of thing.
That's right. The various bureaus, you see, they have a certain allocation. They don't spend the money for one thing, so they spend it for something else. They'd never think of returning it, yeah, you see. And that's... But generally speaking, I didn't have so very, you know, not very much was said. The interesting thing is that I suppose in some respects what's happened to Wally Bladel,
uh-huh, yes,
in a sense, is a sort of thing that could have happened to Les Holt and myself when we were let out of the Inorganic Division, had we wanted to make a fuss about it.
I see.
But it never occurred to me to make the fuss because, first of all, it wouldn't be only for 4 years because mm-hmm. then I'd be retired. And after all, I had given up my graduate students, most of them by that time, you see.
I thought this concern was about the pollution in the department.
His concern, yeah, was, but in other words, the reason for it, but what happened was, in other words, he was voted out of the inorganic or the analytical division, see, for one reason. Now, why I was voted out of the inorganic, I don't know for sure. I never did inquire.
But you weren't voted out, you were never voted in.
Yeah, never voted in, that's what amounts to see. In other words, in a sense, I was excluded. But we might have made a fuss, Les and I. But I thought about it, but I thought there's no justification for it, really. Mm. It is true that I wasn't active in research, but I wouldn't have done any harm staying with the group, you see.
Yeah. What were the alignments in the department? And that you say Farrington Daniels was the strong person in the inorganic chemistry.
Yeah, in the physical.
In physical chemistry. Who were other strong people?
The organic department has always been the strongest department. Right now, the young man who got the salary increase that kept me from getting an increase is what. He's already been elected to the American Men of Science. He's an outstanding.
I don't know. Is that, that's an award I don't know about. Is that more than the National Academy of Science?
Oh, no. No, the National Academy is what I mean.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, the National Academy.
Who is that? Well, there's nothing against him in what you said. It's
no,
not, his
not at all.
He
He's just good.
Yeah.
I just say that you wanted to know what departments were strong. The organic department has always been strong. They've had McIlvain and Adkins and Fisher and Bill Johnson, Al Wilds, people like that. The department has been strong. The only department, I think, the
division. You mean
division?
Yeah.
Division is that's stronger is the biochemistry. Biochemistry is tops in chemistry, then organic, then I think physical.
But biochemistry is not in your department.
No, but I'm just thinking of the chemistry related, but in our department, organic.
Is there, is biochemistry not in the chemistry department because?
It's in the College of Agriculture. But
is that anything to do with how the, I mean, is that true in other universities? Is there a story about it? That's what I'm curious about.
I really don't know for sure whether every, I would say, generally speaking, that biochemistry departments are separate but related to chemistry.
Is there good relations between the
biochemists? Yes, excellent relations. Oh. Excellent relations. But as far as when there's a ranking, you'll see a biochemistry and also chemistry. Mm-hmm. So that there is.
Yeah.
And our biochemistry department, see, from Steenbach and Peterson on, has always been famous.
Yes.
And
yes,
now they have, the most recent one who got a Nobel. Anyway, they're continue to be famous.
Going way back, you came in 1924.
Right.
One of the things that John Williams spoke about was the ultracentrifuge.
Mm-hmm.
There was the visit of the
Swedish, yeah.
Oh, I've forgotten what his last name was, but I've got it written down somewhere.
Oh, gosh.
But that was before you came. So
that's right, year before.
Svedborg,
yes. Yeah. Trey Svedborg. And they built the ultracentrifuge, and then you see John Williams worked with Svedborg. Mm-hmm. In fact, he went to Sweden for a mm-hmm. while. And then he came back, and this was his research. And I suppose, in one respect, that this is the reason why his research is not, you know, he said he hadn't been treated properly.
Yes.
It's true that there wasn't any much originality in his research.
Oh.
He had an ultracentrifuge, and what he did was to look at colloids through the ultracentrifuge, and he separated them. But there wasn't anything outstandingly new in theory that was brought out as a result of his work.
Hmm.
It is not like in organic chemistry where they synthesize something brand new.
Yeah.
And then using that, they went on to prepare all kinds of compounds and then discovered uses for them. They were always breaking new fields, hmm. discovering new plastic. But his was sort of a routine work there.
I see. Do you remember anything about the grant from the Rockefeller Foundation in the 1930s to build the bigger ultracentrifuge?
No.
You don't?
Right. I don't. I don't remember that. I know there was a story about it. I don't know exactly what happened. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He said that he went to Weaver and asked for the grant and that there was a fuss about that.
Mm-hmm.
But then Daniels tells a different story. There's a different story in the chemistry department file. So, if you don't know, I'd like to turn now to generally the university in your own life when you came. What you knew about Glenn Frank, whether you ever encountered him, what your social life was like, how much you participated in the faculty meetings and university club. That's right. Can you think about that sort of thing?
I used to. See, I wasn't married until I was 37 years old.
Oh. So you were a bachelor for a long time.
So I was a bachelor for a long while, and I was the... And during that time then, I I was active, very active socially too. I had, in other words, my students would invite me to their fraternity parties, you see.
I see, yeah.
And then I got me a Ford Roadster with a rumble seat, and, mm-hmm. and so I was active. I play, and I in contrast were the people who, like John Williams, were doing research, would probably be at home doing research. I was out playing golf, or I was out, or in the weekends. The occasion when I met, got to know Glenn Frank is very interesting. Right. I must tell you about that. Now, among other things, my research was on colloid chemistry. It's colloid chemistry a problem. And so that I knew how to operate the ultra microscope so that I could look at things. And I had in one of my classes a boy, a student, who was working on the side for an oil station, a filling station. Mm-hmm. And they had some kind of additive that they would put into the oil and into the gasoline that would tend to keep it from, keep the cylinders from getting burned out. Mm. And so this chap brought some of that to me and wanted to know what there was about it. And I said, well, let's take a look at this under the ultramicroscope. And we discovered that this was a suspension of graphite in some kind of lubricating oil. Mm. And I indicated to him then that all this was a suspension of graphite in lubricating oil, and I didn't make any comment about it being expensive or not, but I said, well, that's all it is. So this, that was it. I had happened to look at it and this product, and it turned out that the product was manufactured by a company in La Crosse. Mm-hmm. Oh, I should remember the name of it now again. Anyway, this chap had told the owner of the filling station that expressed a feeling that he thought that they were charging too much for it, because all it was is a suspension of graphite and lubricating oil. Well, apparently somehow that got around to the company in La Crosse. And first thing you know, in the summer, I used to spend I lived on a farm in Minnesota, and I used to go home for the summer. And I was home that summer, and all of a sudden I got a long distance telephone call from President Frank's office wanting me to come back to Madison right away, because he said my name was mentioned in a suit that was being brought against the department. So I came back, and it turned out that what had happened was that this boy had written a note to the owner of the filling station stating specifically that I had looked at this and indicated there was nothing but graphite and lubricating oil, and I thought they were overcharging it. So this company demanded that I was casting aspersions on a Wisconsin manufacturing concern. They thought I ought to be dropped from the university. So I came back, I saw that. Well, this is my first contact with Glenn Frank. And so I told him the whole story. And after I'd explained it, he realized that I wasn't at fault, that I wasn't being paid for it or anything of that kind. We finally got it cleared up. Mm. But as a result, I got to know Glenn Frank. And And so on two or three different occasions, he called me in to inquire about things with respect to enrollment in chemistry and with respect to facilities. Apparently, the department, Matthews, had put in a request for expansion to accommodate students, and he wanted to know to what extent we were overcrowded and that sort of thing.
That's interesting. So he relied on you because he knew you.
That's right. He got to know me, and I just, you know, gave him some information.
Well,
gave
what
him,
was he like when you went?
Oh, he was a very nice, smooth, friendly person. Very smooth. Mm-hmm. He was. You've seen this picture.
Yes.
He was well dressed, smooth, marvelous speaker, marvelous talker. Yes. And very friendly. Mm-hmm. But apparently, he wasn't liked by all the members of the Board of Regents, and mm-hmm. so they fired him.
Yeah. You didn't move in the same social circles?
Oh, no. No. Oh, I should say not. Mrs. Frank, she'd come to the football games with a huge orchid, you know, one of these on a big stem. I used to wonder exactly how that orchid, you know, how a tall stem orchid, walking through there in the way, completely confident that the stem wouldn't break. We were commenting about that. Well, anyway.
Who were you? You say you had friends among your students. Who were your friends among the faculty?
Bill Johnson. When Bill Johnson came here
in the chemistry department.
In the chemistry department, mm-hmm. he was the only really close friend I had. In fact, most of my friends were among my students.
I see.
Uh-huh. Oddly enough, I spent a lot. Charlie Bradley, Harold Bradley's son, and I were very close friends. He was a student of mine when he was a freshman, and got to know and got well acquainted with him. But until I was 37, you see, I was footloose and fantasy free.
Yeah.
I had completely decided that I would not get married.
Oh.
It's a long story. And then my present wife popped up as a freshman student of mine.
Oh, I see.
And then by the time she got to be a junior, I got invited to one of her sorority parties at the Pi Phi House, and that was the beginning of the end. But I had decided that I wasn't going to get married at all.
Happy end, I gather.
Yes. Oh, yes. Yeah.
Did you go to the university club?
Oh, yes.
You ate lunch there?
That's right. I belonged to the university club, and I ate lunch there.
Who would you eat lunch with?
With the people in the chemistry department.
I see.
Yeah. So that I would say that probably with Bill Johnson and McIlvaine, and Walton, Professor Walton.
And you were on good terms with them?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Oh, yes. There was no problem. I was on good terms with the people in the department, even though, but as I say, on the basis of the standards, I didn't deserve these promotions,
yeah.
You see.
Well.
I really didn't.
Did you go to faculty meetings?
Sure. I went to faculty meetings. I was chairman of the university committee.
I know you were. That's.
And I'll tell you.
Go on.
The interesting thing is that when it came time for the faculty, there were two things. I'm a firm disbeliever in life insurance.
Uh-huh.
And I'm a firm disbeliever in any kind of a system where you contribute and eventually you get paid back, see. And therefore, I was completely opposed to the faculty joining Social Security. And I presented that to the university committee. Mm-hmm. And then on the basis of that, I presented that to the faculty. And I gave them the statistics and showed them exactly what would happen if you, on your own, you invested money at so much every year and left it in there, how much you'd have when, at the end of your life. Mm-hmm. And on that basis, I said that statistically, financially, we would be better off if the faculty stayed away from all kinds of involvement in Social Security or anything similar to it. Mm. And I still believe it. Well, I tell you, I thought I'd be thrown out bodily from that faculty meeting. There were, the minute that I suggested that we should stay away from it, right away quick, somebody says, well, what'll your wife do if you die tomorrow? And I said, I'm not gonna die tomorrow. Mm. And I said, you may. And I gave him the statistics that the statistics showed that that university teachers, faculty, have a longer life on average than any other group of citizens, mm-hmm. which is true. Mm-hmm. And that therefore, the probability that you would die right away was remote. Well, it turned out that there was a chap in the College of Agriculture. He had two children, and he had just dropped dead about a couple of weeks before this meeting. I heard that name right away. This, how about it? How about him? How about him? How about that could happen to any of us? Mm-hmm. Well, I said, if you want to make your investments on the basis of your fear that you're going to die, then of course you want to join Social Security. But I showed them how and I took the amount that if you invested the $200 a year, and you did that every year, and you invested it 5%, I had a statistic to show that by the time you got to be 70 retirement, you'd have something like $800,000 of your own. And that, but that if you invested that in Social Security or in insurance, why then somebody else would get the money when you died, you see.
And, did you do that, by the way?
Sure. None of our SARM relationships carry any insurance. Huh. Oh, but we have our own insurance. For instance, our granddaughter, who is just 6 years old, now has an estate already. She already has an estate of almost $50,000 to her credit.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, because we just invested the money and she's leaving it there. Mm-hmm. And of course, when you get 15% interest, which she was getting for most of the time, it multiplies very fast. Yeah. No, there's nothing. When I say we don't have any insurance, I took out a $5,000 Aetna insurance policy when I graduated from college, which I graduated from college when I was 18 years old. And I've been paying $85. I didn't know anything about insurance. Somebody sold me Straight Life. Mm-hmm. I've been investing $85 every year, once a year, ever since I was 18. I'm now 83. Mm-hmm. And if I had just invested that at 4%, I would now have a fund of not quite $60,000. Oh. And when I die, what'll happen? Somebody will get $5,000. Who gets that? The insurance company. Yeah. That's why insurance companies have so much money, you see. Because it's the biggest racket of all. And people buy insurance because they're afraid to die. Yeah. They aren't going to die. Oh, they may, but it doesn't make any difference.
Do you, Do you know who brought Alberti here, or, let's see, yes?
No, I don't.
You don't, okay.
No.
Incidentally, I must be sure that you sign that. Curious as to who won, whether you won any of the matches down in, where did you go, to Tennessee or North Carolina?
North Carolina. I've never won a first place.
Yeah.
See, but I have won enough, so I've got national ranking.
Is that right?
Yes.
That's wonderful.
But national ranking, but keep in mind, national ranking what? In the 80s and over, mm-hmm. by comparison.
Well, I'm sure there are many good players. So.
Oh, yes. So, oh, yes. So they're sure much better than I am.
I'm sure. But the interesting
thing is, I had to wait until I got to be 80 years old and in tennis before I got the national ranking or something.
Excuse me, if you belong to any dining clubs?
No.
Did?
Not. Well, let me put it this way. When Gar Alperovitz was a student of mine, and then he became president of the union. And he organized a...
Of what union?
Wisconsin Union.
Oh,
Wisconsin
right.
Union. Mm-hmm. And he organized then a luncheon discussion group of various faculty people. Uh-huh. And I was invited to be at, but I think that...
You say you don't belong to any dinner. Some of many of your friends do.
Yes.
Was this painful? Is this something that you felt excluded or?
No, it's a completely choice on my part. The thing is, I'm not, you may not believe it because I've been talking a blue streak here, but in a group, I'm inclined to say very little. Mm-hmm. I don't say very much. And we, for instance, there's a group of four couples of us, the Rudicellis, the Holtz, the Hickeys, Joe Hickey, mm-hmm. and we go to, for instance, Travel Adventure on Monday, mm-hmm. last Monday mm-hmm. night. And before that, we get together at 5 o'clock and have cocktails, and then we have dinner at one of the four homes. Uh-huh. And this is a very, a very outspoken group, mm-hmm. But I sit in the background and listen most of the time because I don't have very much say. And I don't know, I never have been one who would participate in lively discussion. To me, an ideal way to spend an evening is to play bridge.
Oh.
Because then I don't have to say a word. I enjoy myself. And I like to play bridge, and it isn't necessary for me to talk, and the fact that I have nothing to say doesn't interfere. But, so I'm not the one who will lead much discussion, and that's why.
I guess I'm asking little bits of questions as they occur to me. You said E.B. Fred intervened once on your behalf. Did you have much to do with him when he was president? Did you know him?
Here's how we got to, you know, he lived in the house at the varsity tennis courts were right next to his home.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rosalie was learning to play tennis, and I was helping Rosalie with her tennis, and so therefore, we got to know Mr. and Mrs. Fred, mm-hmm. and my wife then got to know him too. And so up until the time Mrs. Fred passed away, every year, or even oftener than once a year, Emma Lou and somebody else would have lunch with Mrs. Fred. Mm-hmm. And no, I got to know Mr. Fred very well. He and I used to swap tomato plants. He'd raise fine tomatoes. And no, he was very friendly. As I told, he intervened in my behalf. Mm-hmm. can't remember whether it was a promotion or it was a salary increase or something, at least.
Would it be due to him that you got onto the university committee?
I suppose so. I'm not sure. I don't know exactly how I got, you know, whatever it was, I can't remember exactly how I got onto the university committee.
Because I find it puzzling, the way you seem to have been treated in the department doesn't seem to accord with your being, reaching the point of being on the university committee.
That's right. That's right.
Prestigious position.
I suppose that's, it could be that there was, might have been some jealousy because why should I be on the university committee when someone like Farrington Daniels, for instance, was on the committee. But,
well, why?
I don't know.
Why did that happen?
I don't know why. I was on the first university committee that I was on was the Committee on Student Conduct, the Faculty Committee on Student Conduct, in which we handled cases of student misconduct.
This was in the 30s, was it?
You know, I can't remember. It's a long time ago.
Were you working with Scott Goodnight or?
Yeah, with Dean Glixman. Glixman was
one. Oh, I see. Yes.
Yeah. Way back.
Way back then. Yeah.
Scott Goodnight was dean of men at the time. I think.
See. Yeah. Right.
And maybe that's where I started on that committee, and then I was on other committees.
Were you effective on committees? You say you don't talk very much.
Well, at that time, I was much more effective than I am now. I've gotten, I'll tell you, this treatment that I got from the department really squelched me, I can tell you that. And so I used to be much more outgoing than I am.
And more self-confident.
That's right, that's right. But I'll have to admit that I lost my confidence. And the last 2 or 3 years of my teaching, I was almost apprehensive in my teaching because that's when the students began to rebel.
Oh, yes. Remember. Let's go on to the committees. I'd like to ask you about that, but since you were talking about the Student Conduct Committee, so you were an effective member of committees.
That's right. That's right. The Student Conduct. And, for instance, on the University Committee, I mean, you would put it this way, I dared to come out. I think the most contentious action was when the university, somebody in the university, I don't know who originates these things, came out and asked for an across-the-board salary increase for all faculty, across the board. There were people in the social science, the man who was chairman of the public speaking department at the time was the chairman of the group. This whole group put in a request that there be an across-the-board salary increase, a certain amount. And that then was finally put in the lap of the university committee. And I was the chairman at the time. On the basis, we reported to the faculty, and our recommendation was against it. And we set up a resolution that we felt that increases in salary should be only on the basis of merit. Hmm. There should be no such a thing as across the board salary increases, flat increases for everybody, but that all increases should be based on merit. And I presented that to the faculty. There, oh my,
didn't like that either.
Oh, they didn't like that at all. They didn't like that at all. And I pointed out that, well, does the faculty, if we did this, this would be place the faculty in the same bracket with all labor unions. And that we felt that we were a cut above that. But one of the arguments that were presented were very, I can't remember, but I can recall particularly the professor from sociology department, I can't remember, one department. It indicated that, well, suppose in a department, the chairman of the department dislikes you. You won't get any salary increase. And our argument was, well, if there was such a chairman, why the dean should kick him out. We tried to defend this, but we were voted down. In other words, the university committees, I made quite a fuss there. It was one of the first times, I think, that the action of the university committee had ever been voted down by the general faculty.
Yes, it's unusual.
Yes, absolutely unusual. And I was the chairman, and I'd presented it. And I really took a lot of beating until finally, in the course of the discussion, I don't remember exactly all went on, but finally I just refused to answer any more questions. I said, this is our presentation. This is what we believe, and if you like it, accept it. If you don't like it, vote it down. And they voted it down. And then, there was across the board increase. But that was quite a long time ago.
It was in 1956.
Yeah.
There was something else. A report. For the need for additional research funds, pointing out that money was readily available to the biological sciences. Do you remember that?
Yes.
And I think you signed or wrote the letter.
Urging this.
Yes. Now, do you remember how that came about?
I don't remember the details, no.
Was that something you yourself felt strongly about, that the social sciences and humanities should be getting more funding?
Right. I felt that way.
Because I know that Fred Harrington and Bill Sewell and Ed Young and some others were very much concerned about that.
That's right. That's right.
And usually the scientists were on the other side.
Well, I was in favor of the fact, and I sort of got fed up on the, because it seems like the sciences had the advantage of the alumni research funds, and therefore the social sciences need to get some other source of funds.
Did Harrington ever come and talk to you about it? Do you remember?
No.
He was.
Very strong.
He would have been vice president then.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. Eventually, it resulted in the Alumni Research Foundation giving some money to social sciences.
Yeah. It was interesting to see that.
Yeah.
Speaking of unions, you obviously had nothing to do with the teachers' union.
No, that was. After I retired.
In the
1930s. That's right. It got started before that.
There was. It was a different one.
Yeah.
Associated the teachers' union. The 1930s.
That's right. We don't have the now the graduate teaching assistants.
Oh yeah, that's totally different.
Oh yes.
But they raised quite a fuss that the university committee had to concern itself with in the 1930s, having to do with exploitation of people at lower ranks, such as instructors. Do you remember anything about
that?
No.
I can't remember that happened anything like that happened while I was on the committee.
No, this was in the 30s.
Oh, yes.
You yourself may have thought you were being exploited. I don't know. But
no, at least, I think when I my early career, I was very meek. I was darn glad that I had a chance to get a teaching assistantship here. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that we were paid about $400 a year the first year, mm-hmm. and $600 the next, and $800 the next, something like that.
You know, there's one thing I meant to ask you. When one looks at the catalog in 1925, there are listed in the chemistry department 47, I think they're called assistants. And then when you look at the catalog for 1929-30, it's got, I don't know, 10 or so faculty and no assistants. Do you remember what happened?
No, isn't that interesting?
It's just, I guess, a different way of looking at it.
Could be.
The chemistry department has been severely criticized for getting young people, getting them into the department as assistants, graduate students, and not paying them very much. Are you aware of that?
Well, as I say, at the time we weren't paid very much, but I was darn glad.
I mean, I'm jumping back again to the 1960s and 70s, that they've been criticized for not.
I can't remember that.
All right, okay.
It seems like we were paying our assistants as much as other schools were paying their assistants, I think.
I'm curious. You said that you were affected by the student, the protest and the student, especially the TA activism at the end of the 1960s. How mm-hmm. you say it, you taught with some trepidation.
That was right at the very end. I think that it may not have been justified, see. But, for instance, I would have the experience that I would be lecturing and there would be students that were deliberately going to sleep in my lecture.
Oh.
Ignoring, in other words, not paying attention. And at that time also, there were not necessarily my students, but around the university there was a movement on the part of students that they were objecting to what was being required in the courses, see. Mm-hmm. And I guess probably I was just sort of worried for fear that it might happen rather than that anything did happen.
Yeah.
No, I would say this, that my students treated me royally all the time. Mm-hmm. They really did.
That's nice.
I wasn't involved in the politics of the university at all at that mm-hmm. time. And therefore, I think my feeling on this would be best expressed. At that time, I have a first cousin who had just graduated from the seminary, and he was a great admirer of President Frank, mm-hmm. and he had listened to any number of his speeches. Mm-hmm. And when Glenn Frank was fired, then Islet, when I saw him in the summer, he wanted to know why in the world would any university deliberately fire someone of the caliber of Glenn Frank? Mm-hmm. And that's the time when I suppose maybe I thought too that, well, the presidency of the university, this is really a political appointment, mm-hmm. unfortunately. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason for it, and therefore, anytime you get involved in politics, well, you have to expect something like that.
So you thought he was of high quality?
Oh, I should say so. By the way, I got my PhD during his first year at the university.
Uh-huh.
And the commencement was held out in the stadium. And it absolutely poured rain. And here I can still see Glenn Frank standing there, dripping rain, but giving the marvelous speech. He's a marvelous. My mother had come down from Lanesboro, Minnesota, to be there. Poor mom, she got soaked with me. But, yeah.
But there are people who say he was really a lightweight and not really of the intellectual caliber of that a university president should have.
Could be, could be. I wouldn't know that. In some respects, to me, Glenn Frank came over in some respects like Ronald Reagan. He's a polished speaker. Mm. Polished speaker, see. But somehow you got the impression that there were more words there than there were ideas. Mm. That's the only thing. He was a smooth talker. Very, very smooth. No, I can see, I understand, he was a politician and he was not intellectual enough. Yeah. But the one who was not intellectual.
Dykstra.
Dykstra is the one who was the least intellectual. Mm. And Dykstra was just like a businessman. And of course he was brought in by the business interest in the state, I understand. Uh-huh. Dykstra. Yeah.
Did you have any dealings with Celery?
Not very much, because he was dean of the graduate school, you see.
No, you think the Slichter, well, Celery.
It's the College of Letters and Science, yes. Yeah, that's right. No, Slichter was a graduate school, Celery. No, Celery, to me, Celery was aloof. It seemed like he was so aloof. I don't think I ever carried on a conversation with Celery. I'm not sure. Hmm. No. The distinction of Ed Young, the contrast between Ed Young and Celery is outstanding. See, I work over in the hospital on Thursday afternoons.
Yeah.
And any number of times, Ed Young has come over there. He came over there to visit Ingram once in a while. He always stops and chats with me and calls me Harvey. You know? He's so friendly. And while he was chancellor, he was the same way. He was very friendly. And his wife was very friendly to Emma Lou. Mm-hmm. But in contrast, Celery was aloof. Celery was an intellectual type, I suppose.
Yeah, he's very autocratic. He clearly
apparently was.
Everybody feels that way.
Yeah.
Paul Napland was somebody who spoke at university meetings, faculty meetings a lot.
Oh, he was always, Paul Napland, I wouldn't say he always had something to say. And usually it was something worthwhile.
It was.
Yes, he was. But he was one of those. It's a good thing to have people like him on a faculty because he would always see to it that every stone was turned so that you would expose everything. Mm. You see, and his ideas, I thought, generally were pretty good.
Are there other people you think of that stand out in your memory?
Well, the one who stands out to me is Homer Adkins in chemistry. But interestingly enough, Homer Adkins wasn't involved in university politics very much, university affairs. For instance, he never was on the university committee or wasn't that important to me. I have a feeling it was a matter of choice on his part.
You think, in other words, he was an outstanding person?
Yes, an outstanding personality. He was an outstanding scientist, outstanding in research. His contribution to hydrogenation practices was, tremendous.
More so than Daniels?
As far as the results, there's no comparison to it. In other words, Adkins, the results of Adkins' research in hydrogenation, mm-hmm. He was responsible for billion-dollar industries, you see, his work. While I suppose in theory, Daniels, for years, he had the decomposition of proof that the decomposition of something was a monomolecular reaction. Mm-hmm. That was in the news for many years. But it didn't, it was of theoretical interest. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't in a class with Adkins' contribution, in my judgment. Mm-hmm. Daniels was a great scientist. There's no question about that. But as far as the results of his scientific efforts, I don't think that it begins to compare with Adkins. Mm. But here I'm thinking of the potential commercial value of what he did. Mm-hmm. In other words, I feel, after all, I feel if you're going to do some research, you ought to do something that'll contribute to the welfare of humanity. Mm. And in that respect, you see, Adkins' hydrogenation research was tremendous, absolutely tremendous.
How would you say the university has changed since you came here?
Well, I was interested in, this is one interesting thing, I can't recall exactly what year it was, but it was sometime after 1929, anyway, when we were in a depression. And I can still practically hear the president of the university,
Dykstra.
No, earlier than that. 1929.
Well, Frank came in 25.
And then he was followed by?
Dykstra.
And then?
Fred. You're getting?
No, there's someone before Fred.
No, it's Frank, Dykstra, and Fred.
Who preceded Frank? What were the dates? You can give me, what were the
dates? Well, I'm not sure when he came, something mm-hmm. like 1918 or 19, I think.
Yes.
And he was here until 25, I guess.
25. Anyway, during the, following the Depression, we were in a financial bind. And so at that time, the president of the university presented the case to the faculty that there were two things that could happen. Either we could reduce the number of people in each department, division, and fire them, or we could all take a reduction in salary and everybody stay.
Yeah.
And what shall you do? Mm-hmm. And everybody took a reduction in salary, without any whimper at all. Mm-hmm. In contrast, that the last few years, the faculty, we have to have an increase in salary because the cost of living has gone up a little bit, mm-hmm. see. And in contrast, somehow it just seems as though the faculty now has gotten to be money mad, money hungry. They've got to have increases in salary. Mm-hmm. And the argument to me, I can't see the justice of the argument. One of my friends, isn't important who he is, his salary at the time was $40,000. Oh, yes, he said, he says, I need a salary increase of 11% because the cost of living is going up 11%. And therefore, and I, so we said, well, 40,000, you don't need to have 11% more money to live. Probably the graduate teaching assistants need some increase in salary, but you don't. You've got so much salary already. No, all they talk about is the cost of living has gone up, therefore our salaries, no matter how high they are, ought to go up some more. And this is a thing, of course, that's been, that's happening all along the line. The federal, all the federal salaries are going to go up, was it 7% or something?
I've forgotten. No. I know
they're going to go up.
About city salaries, and yes, it does.
But this is the difference in the philosophy. It just seems like there's salaries have gotten to be such an important factor. I suppose I should say there's no, if everybody else is going to get an increase in salary, the faculty ought to too. So
well,
I guess it's just
always been the,
that's a general trend.
The steps that it went on.
Yeah. That's right. That's right. But at the same time, the contrast was that the back there, the faculty decided that they had a good thing, that give everybody a chance to stay out and work at a little less salary would be the fine thing to do. But nowadays, everybody has to have a salary increase.
You know, I'm still puzzling over, I still find, I was thinking about your Phi Beta Kappa honorary membership. So in other words, there were people in the university who, and you were on a number of committees, aren't you, when you're
I was well known around the university. Harvey Sorum, around the whole university, I was known as an outstanding teacher. And the thing is, that's why it sort of irked me that my own department, that I couldn't rank there. Here, National Science Foundation selects me for these things,
and you were on the, oh, you were on the Union Council.
Sure, I was on the Union.
The Freshman Forum.
Yeah.
And you were in ILS.
Right.
So all of those things are. It's just surprising that the department wasn't impelled to sort of pick up your salary. It really seems unusual to me.
Well,
I mean, invisible people, one understands that. You know, there are people who in departments who just don't, nobody pays any attention to. But you were
sure. Yes, I was in many respects the most visible. I mean, I would be known around the state.
Yes.
And there, other people around wouldn't know. Any number of my friends said, "Well, gee, Harvey, why aren't you chairman of the department?"
Yeah.
And I